Okay, well, I think that things are starting to level off a little bit. Shall I go ahead and start things off? What do you think?
It is 6:35, so it looks like that might be a good time.
Okay. All right, well, welcome everybody. Thanks so much for being here. My name is Greg Dixon. I am the chair of the Pacific Northwest section. And I work as assistant professor of music and sound design at a university here in Washington called DigiPen Institute of Technology in Redmond, Washington. And I'd like to welcome you all to our June meeting. And I'd like to thank every one of you for being here tonight, if it is the nighttime. And I hope you're all staying safe and healthy. We're all really excited today to be able to host this presentation called Tools and Techniques for Streaming Audio by Bill Gibson. So thank you so much, Bill. And today, in addition to Bill's presentation, we will be conducting our annual election as well. And we're going to be doing that in the opening portion of the meeting. In order to start that, I need to collect some numbers for us to figure this out. And the first thing that I need to do is to get a count of how many global AES members we have with us here tonight. And I think the easiest way to do this would be if you can chat, to just simply chat into the chat window. Yes, I am a member, and we'll count those. Or if for some reason you are unable to chat, if we could just have you shout out to us into your mic and let us know you're a member right now.
It's a crapshoot. You're trying to plan a salad around it.
But not all
Good
at
luck.
once. So, how about our telephone guest?
Yeah. No, let me tell you what. You're just tomatoes don't count, but
No, that didn't work.
that sounded like a party.
You bet.
You know, I was thinking in the last one of these that we did with Brian, that's a lot of times, you know, for the presenter, it's like dead silent. They should have like a crowd mode, you know, it's like where everybody's mic's on, but real quiet. So if you say something funny, people can laugh at you. And if you say something stupid, people can yell at you.
Get room tone.
Yeah.
We need to go into Walla mode for you, Bill.
That'd be awesome.
Excuse me, Mr. Dixon. James here from
Yes.
California. For those of us who've never attended one of these meetings, could you possibly just give us a little background on AES and what this exactly is?
Sure. So I'll try my best here, and I think I may invite others who have been with the organization even longer than me to also chime in if they want. But the AES is the Audio Engineering Society, and it's an international organization that's dedicated to promoting both the art and the science of recording, sound engineering, music engineering, really everything related to audio engineering. So that includes things like computer programming and DSP, recording, mix engineering, that kind of thing. And I actually don't on the I'm a little bit on the spot. I don't know how long the when the organization was started, but it's been around for a long time, and we've got thousands of members all over the world. Does anybody want to add to that for me?
May I add a couple of comments? It was
Absolutely. Thank
started
you.
in 1948 in New York, and in addition to all the things that Greg just said, it's also a standards association. Prior to the AAS's existence, there were things like phonographs out there that didn't you if you were Columbia Records, you made a record, you also had to play it back on a Columbia record player for it to work properly because the pre-emphasis and de-emphasis curves were different from brand to brand. And that goes on to all the different things up to today, where we're dealing with digital standards for transmitting audio, for instance. And the AES sets a lot of those standards in its various committees, and then those get promulgated out to the world.
Thank you.
Thank you, David. So just again, if I could give folks just a moment to chime in, if you cannot chat, and just say, I'm a member, if you cannot chat.
Okay. We have a pretty good list in the chat.
At this point in time, I would like to turn things over to Dave Tosti Lane, who will be helping us with the election today. So Dave, if you take it away.
Okay, thank you, Greg. Welcome everyone. We'll try to see if we can make this go as quickly as possible. I guess I should say the obligatory, am I coming through okay? Everyone can hear me, I assume. I'm Dave Tosti Lane. I'm a lifetime AES member and member at large in the Pacific Northwest AES Committee. I'm filling in for the election committee chair, Dan Mortensen, who may be delayed in joining us this evening. Our process is not super complicated, although the virtual nature of the meeting adds a couple of quirks. Our bylaws specify that you must be a Pacific Northwest AES member, either full or associate or lifetime, to take part in the election. Student members are not eligible to vote. We require a quorum of a minimum of 15 members to hold an election, and I've been watching the numbers as we come in, and we have that quorum currently with people in the meeting. We also have a small number of members who could not attend, and they've asked me to take care of their vote by absentee, so I'll be doing that if necessary. So at this time, we have 4 open officer slots and 4 nominations, and 5 open committee slots and 5 nominations. So if it turns out there are no further nominations, we may be able to shorten the process using an election by acclamation. More on that later if that turns out to be the case. So in order to save time, if we do need to conduct a regular election, we just did the chat thing with global members. And so I'm asking any member of Audio Engineering Society Pacific Northwest to send a private chat message to me, Dave Tosti Lane. My name should show up in the chat dropdown as a co-host. And just indicate that you are a member of the Pacific Northwest. That will give me a list if I need to send voting instructions out to members of the Pacific Northwest, which we'll see in a minute. And I'll be working through that list then and send those voting instructions if necessary. Okay, so while that's happening, I'm going to briefly describe the committee responsibilities and read the list of current nominations. And I'm going to share a screen that shows the hopefully, if I get the right one, that shows the duties of the committee. I'm not going to read through it all. I'm just putting that up there if anybody wants to peek at that while I'm talking here. Basically, committee members attend all meetings of the committee, both business meetings and events like this, and assist the officers in running the section, provide support for any meetings or events. Each committee member is also expected to take on at least one meeting each year, planning and facilitating the meeting as meeting coordinator. This is a pretty remarkable group of people, and serving on the committee is generally a pleasure. For more details about the duties of section officers, you can also go to the link that's at the bottom of the screen right there, or you can find this by searching on our website as well. So now I'm going to leave this up while I read off the list of the currently nominated candidates. So nominations for officers are as follows. For chair, Greg Dixon, who is our current chair seeking re-election. Vice chair, Bob Smith, who is a current committee member. Secretary, Gary Louie, current secretary seeking re-election. Treasurer, Lawrence Schwedler, current treasurer seeking re-election. Candidates for the 5 committee positions are as follows. Bill Gibson, our presenter this evening, current committee member seeking re-election. Katie Gray, architectural acoustician, recent presenter for our section seeking her first term. Steve Kirk, musician, composer, educator, seeking a first term. Jim Rondinelli, CEO for Immersion Networks, Inc., record producer and engineer, seeking a first term. And Matt Stearns, senior audio engineer at Stryker, live and recording engineer and mixer, seeking his first term. And I'm going to stop sharing if I can figure out where, there we go, right now. And at this point, I would like to open the floor to any additional nominations. In order to be added to the slate, a candidate must be nominated or self-nominated and seconded by a Pacific Northwest AES member. Nomination can be by voice, but please also send a chat message in case we don't hear you. So, do we have any further nominations? Okay, unless my headphones are dead, which I hope is not the case, I'm not hearing any further nominations.
I agree with that.
So, at this point, if there are no further nominations and we have exactly one candidate for each position, we have the opportunity to proceed with an election by acclaim. In order to do this, we would need a PNW AES member to make a motion to accept the slate as it stands and another to second that motion. Voice motion. Go ahead.
I move to accept the slate as it stands.
Thank you.
I second that motion.
That motion is seconded. So we have a motion and a second to proceed with an election by acclaim. If any PNW AES member objects to so proceeding, please say so at this time. Terrific. So hearing no objection, I declare the slate of candidates elected by the quorum present by acclaim. Congratulations to the new officers and committee members. And I will turn the meeting back over to Greg.
Woohoo!
Great.
Yay!
Awesome.
Hey, Dave?
Yes.
This is Gary.
Yes.
What was the number of members over the quorum?
My, hang on a second, and let me just check. My quick count, based just on our list of, on the people who are here and the people identified in our Eventbrite list is, let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right, great. Thank you so much, Dave. Appreciate all that. I just need to give one quick technical note before I turn it over to Steve Turnage, who will introduce our guest speaker this evening. Just a quick technical note that we value all of your thoughts and your feedback, but our meetings can risk becoming a little disorganized if everyone is able to chime in with their microphones all at once. For that reason, we would like for you, if you have a question for our presenter tonight, to just type it into the chat. And then Steve Turnage, who is going to be our moderator this evening, will help forward those questions to Bill, and then we can talk about them and you can talk some more if you need to. Just a quick note, if you don't already know, the microphone mute button is on the lower left-hand corner of your Zoom window, and the chat is in the bottom middle portion of your window. Now,
go ahead.
Now I'd like to go ahead and ask Steve Turnage to help introduce our speaker.
Hello, I'm Steve. I'm a mastering engineer and circuit board designer, and I wrote a couple of books. And the way I wrote a couple of books is that Bill Gibson discovered me for Hal Leonard Books, and I mean, desktop mastering and beyond mastering. And so I'm infinitely grateful to Bill, and he's always been ahead of the curve. If you want to see what's going to happen, you watch Bill. He's also written around 40 books, I think, and is continually advancing the art. He was also a trustee of the Recording Academy, as well as being a committee member here. And Bill, if you would like to take the screen, I would love that. And if anyone wants to ask questions as it comes through, I'm more than happy to look in the chat and interrupt Bill, because that's sort of what I do. I I interrupt Bill. That's my job.
Awesome. And you're good at it too, man.
Well, wait. No, sorry. Okay. Just practicing.
Oh, cool. Hey, well, thanks everybody for showing up for this. I mean, it's a topic that I have kind of been thrown into, and I have a lot of energy for it, and I'm excited about the stuff that's going on. And, and just to go back for a sec, the AES, I mean, it is everything they said it was, but to me, the first AES I went to was in the mid 80s. And it was the first time that everything became real, because all of the people that I had heard of and all of the gear that I had heard of was there. All the new stuff's introduced at AES conventions. And they used to be New York, 1 year, LA the next year, or San Francisco for a while. But it's well worth your time. And and you get a lot out of it. I mean, there are super, super smart people there. I mean, there are sessions where people are introducing new concepts that you won't see anything about for a long time. I saw the first ADAT there, stood in line for 2 hours in New York to get into the room. And it was a great experience. And then I saw the first, I don't know, Lexicon Capricorn. I saw the first Studio Live Personas. It's all there. So it's a cool organization. And it's full of a lot of super smart people, and I'm more of a drummer than anything. So, you know, I bow in their science. So anyway, I'll get started here. So this topic, and I'll go ahead and start sharing my screen. How about I do it this way? There we go. Click that. And then go into presenter dude mode. So I've designed systems, video systems for overflow rooms in different facilities and been through picking out cameras and been through all of that stuff and picking out, you know, the cable and everything. But this really happened because of, this, I wrote an ebook, and it's called Stream Great Sounding Audio. I think it's in here somewhere. Well, it doesn't matter. It is on another page. And the reason I did that is because we in our church, and I'm coming at this from the standpoint of our church and what we've been through and the things I've learned through that and the things that I was able to apply from the old school to the new school. And so a lot of you guys will relate to a lot of this stuff, but it's really important to embrace what we're in right now, because I don't think we're going out of it. And I know that, on March 15th for all the churches around, it was like stream or die time. You know, it's like, what the heck, you know? And I had proposed a few different systems to our church for streaming over the past couple of years. And it was like, yeah, that'd be really cool. And then don't hear anything about it. But when this happened, you know, we really had to make some stuff happen. So we're seeing all of this stuff through my filter, you know, and I've started to call myself a veteran audio engineer because old was too painful. And, it's like, well, I've been doing this for like, I don't know, a long time, you know, 45 or more years. And then that's probably cutting it short a little bit. It's just too hard to say that. So I've been doing this a long time. I've taught at the Art Institute. I teach at Berkeley right now, which is an awesome experience. I love every one of my students, and they're all super smart. And I've written a lot of books and developed a lot of videos, and I've worked with a lot of people. Steve mentioned that. But this is all through my filter, and that's, I think, when you have anybody – anybody who teaches something, you're kind of living through their filters. So I've done a lot of jingles and broadcast audio, and that's a lot of the stuff that I've drawn on for this information. And I kind of covered some of that stuff right there. So when all of this happened and we did a stream, we basically, our system developed was my daughter, who is the worship pastor and the executive pastor at our church, and super smart, really good. She's fantastic. It was like, well, we got to stream this thing, you know? So it's like, well, Facebook Live was the path of least resistance. So, and I came up with, Well, I came up with, I've got some microphones to hold up here, but the first thing that I thought of was, well, I've got these really cool Sennheiser Ambio headphones, and they're little headphones that, oh, there you go. They're little headphones that go on your, you probably can't even see that, but they go in your ear, but there's a microphone on the outside, so it's kind of like your Neumann head. And they sound really good. They work really well. It's very, very nice stereo image. And it's like, well, maybe I'll just sit there and do that. And then it's like, well, no. Probably should do a little bit more than that. And, you know, so it's...
Bill, yeah. There's a question of people aren't seeing your picture, even though it is, I am seeing it as the, as in the grid view and thumbnail views. Some people aren't seeming to see that. So I'm not sure how we can solve that.
Well, we'll probably got to have to go back in.
It's not you. You're doing fine. I think it's more that because I'm getting some questions that the cam is off. But
okay, let me stop sharing and reshare because there was a second there where things sort of felt bound up to me. So
yeah, the screen share is working fine.
Okay,
and
so
and now and if anyone has questions, actually feel free to come out of unmute.
And do you want me to go back into presenter mode or just kind of slog through the slides this way?
No, go to presenter. You're good.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
No, good job. So, you know, one thing leads to another, and then all of a sudden, you know, it's like, okay, I'll bring in a board, and we'll set up some mics, and we'll just mic you guys. And there were just three. There was my daughter and another guy playing, both playing guitars, and another guy playing tom-tom. You know, it's just that. And so it was kind of cool, but my daughter the night before, she said, you know, might be cool if the mics looked good. So I brought a bunch of mics that looked good. You know, it got out of control. So every week through this thing, we've made a progression. And a lot of this that we're going to cover in here is some of the stuff that I've learned through that. And it's not, and we had a little conversation about this last night, but a lot of this is about how you make it sound good. That's really what the topic of this is. How do you make a stream sound good? And I did some research, you know, and I looked up some things, and almost everything is somebody saying, you know, don't talk into the speaker of your computer, talk into a USB microphone, you know, or get a better USB microphone. Or, but there was nothing that said, how do you build a mix for a stream that's going to sound good, be efficient, sound as loud as it needs to be, and still be clear. So that's really where I started with this stuff. And I kind of had this idea, there's my idea icon, that a lot of the stuff that I grew up doing, okay, so I'm a live sound guy. I've been in the studio forever. Was chief engineer in the studio in Seattle for a long time, then became an independent producer, and did a lot of radio ads and that kind of stuff. And I learned a lot about that. And you learn a ton about radio when you mix something and you send it out there and yours sounds worse than everybody's. It's just far too painful. So you can't let it happen too many times. So I learned a lot of different ways, you know, kind of by the time I was, you know, a couple of years into that, my stuff kind of sounded, you know, as good or better than most people's. And it was just, I discovered a couple of things. So that's the way streaming is too, because it's a broadcast medium. It's not a live sound medium. And we're going to go way into that. The new part of this, I have it's an Allen & Heath SQ5 mixer, and I put an SQ6 in our church, and that really helps. You can use any mixer for a stream. I mean, I've got an old Mackie 1604 something with the FireWire digital audio card in it, in the same cabinet that my golf clubs have been in for a number of years. And I, you know, you could use that, or you could use a little Behringer mixer, and you can do it all, use anything. But, you know, there's a lot with new technology that really makes a big, big difference in terms of creating a stream for an audio stream. And monitors and headphones are a big consideration. So we're going to take a look at that. You've got you know, big speakers, little speakers, you've got full range, limited range. And really the purpose for considering all these things is so that we can build a mix that sounds good on your buddy's home hi-fi system that cost $80,000 or coming out of an old school iPhone mono. You know, it's just, it has to all sound good. The game people come up against a lot of these same things. But they're all broadcast considerations. You know, it's a very, very, it's a different world. So, and we're going to talk about all those things. I've got a lot of examples that I'm going to try to play and I think they're going to sound good today. So, and there's the mono stereo thing. I mean, I keep telling my students all the time, you know, if you do a mix and it sounds great in stereo, hooray for you, but it has to sound good in mono also. And old school wise, that's because AM radio and TV were mono, you know, and they were lo-fi and you had to mix everything so that it sounded good in mono. So you always had to consider that. And let me see what comes up next here. So for the mixer, here's the SQ5 for, and it really is a cool board. It's got great sounds in it. It's super. It's 9624. And that's the reason I bought it for the church is because I was like, we were using 4824. Nobody was going up, at least in the price range we could afford. And Alan Heath came out with this thing, man, and it's just like 9624. It sounds great. The reverbs are fantastic. But so to monitors, if you look at this and you see the Yamaha NS10s there with a little Oratone in the middle, that's what many of us stared at for a large section of our lives between the, I don't know, 70s to the, I don't know, now probably still. Because the Oratones wasn't that easy to get a great mix out of them. And if you got one, it sounded pretty good everywhere. But really what you would do is you would set up your mix so that you had everything stereo as much as you could afford to go stereo. And in that era, you could go wide stereo, but it never collapsed well to mono. So you'd kind of get everything, you know, panned out stereo a little bit, and then you'd sum everything to mono and mix through that one little Oratone. And that's what we deal with today in the streaming world, is that kind of mentality where you have to know what it's going to sound like on your iPad coming out of the speaker on the iPad. And you have to know what it's going to sound like coming out of the you know, the white headphones that come with your iPhone, and you have to know what it's going to sound like on a kind of a lo-fi laptop. So that little speaker there is what everybody trusted. If you could get it to sound good there, and if you could sum it to mono, you'd go right down to the wire. You know, it's like, okay, that's how it's supposed to sound. And it wasn't, it's something that everybody was doing. I mean, I know I've gotten a chance to work with some iconic engineers and producers. And so I know that it wasn't me. It was everybody, you know, Bruce Swedeen was doing it. When he was doing all the Michael Jackson stuff, you would get it there and then you just mix it in mono for TV and radio. And it always sounded good. And it always worked well when you went from that one little mono Oratone out to the NS10s in stereo and out to the far field monitors on the wall far, far away. So that always worked well, but it never worked well to make something that sounded on the big speakers, sounded great on the big speakers in stereo, and then you collapse it down to mono. That just never worked. So, you know, the way that you monitor is key. You have to take all of these things into consideration. It's really important what happens on your phone, in your headphones, in your speakers, little speakers, big speakers, and in your car, because anybody who's done music ever knows that it doesn't sound good until it sounds good in your car. So all of those things are important. And then in the upper right-hand corner, which I can't hardly see because I see the strip of people there, is a Zoom icon. And this, it just hit home. It's like, I am on the right track with this stuff, because last night, a few of us got together and kind of tested out the stream. And this is really the first one of these that we've done that's had any musical example. So we really haven't had to experience this yet. But we got on Zoom and I'm playing my stuff and I got my headphones on here and it sounds good to me. Sounds really good. And then Steve breaks in at some point. He says, well, I'm getting a lot of comments here from the guys on the chat. It's like, well, it's not really sounding very good. And And so it's the same principle. It's like, I didn't know, you know, I didn't go to Steve's house and listen to what he was hearing. I couldn't, I just, and I didn't, I thought, maybe I thought the process would be a little farther along than it is. So it sucked. It was bad. And then, so today I spent a lot of today just trying to figure this out. Cause you know, when you come up with a problem like that, it's like, dang, that's bad. And, so, you know, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what the codec was that they're using. What are they doing? They're very hush-hush about that. And I could, you know, I found some things, you know, I went to, when I, like I said earlier, when I went on and tried to do some research, it's like, well, a lot of dance instructors with their microphone clipped onto their dancewear say, yeah, get one of those microphones. But, it's, you know, what we're trying to do is, you know, far and above that. And so nobody was really covering any of that stuff. So that's why I kind of went down this road. And so let me see where I'm at. Okay. So I mentioned the mono thing, and this is just, I probably went at it pretty early. I'm seeing these are popping in front of me the same time they're popping in front of you. You know, in stereo, you can put everything out there, all the huge guitar left and right. But then when you collapse everything to the pile of mush called mono, everything's fighting for attention. And, you know, that really huge guitar that's big, wide stereo is just kind of like nothing now, you know. So there's all sorts of stuff. We really need to be aware of what's going on with that. And my Zoom thing was just reinforcement. So I don't know why it doesn't let me do this. So today I went on and I figured out what's going on with Zoom. So there are certain things that you have to do in Zoom, and I figured I'd just share it since I learned it. I want you to know it too. So in your Zoom, in Zoom, if you go to in the web browser, not in the app, not in the application, but in the web browser, if you go to zoom.us/profile, your profile should just pop up because you're logged in. And if you go down way down to the bottom and go up two pages, you'll see this, allow users to select stereo audio in their client settings. And that has to be checked or it can't be stereo. So mine wasn't. And so everything we were hearing the other night was mono because I was ignorant about that. And when I was going and looking the second thing below that, I was going and looking at my the app, you know, the preferences in the app, and you just go command comma or click the upper things in the upper right or the little arrow down the lower left corner. I didn't have the enable stereo button there. So it took me a while to figure that one out. And then there's also, if you go into this advanced tab of this very same window, and you'll notice down lower left, you have to have share computer sound selected. But when you hit the advanced tab, you have to go into, you have to select, and it's not, none of these are selected. These are opposite of the defaults. You do have to select show in meeting options, enable original sound from microphone. And, if you don't do that, it's not going to work right. I mean, and I don't totally get it, but it's, I use an Element 80, Apogee Element 88 for my interface. My mic goes to that. My music comes from that. And so if it's trying to get the music from somewhere else and it won't be stereo, it seems like a legitimate problem. And then also there's a problem with their suppress persistent background noise and suppress intermittent background noise. So all of these things, and the reason I'm mentioning this is because every one of these things that we stream to has these kind of options. And you know, I looked in, you know, Facebook's has options like this. YouTube, I mean, it's a little bit more hi-fi. But
Bill, there's a comment.
Okay.
David Angris says, one concern about setting your Zoom app to stereo, it uses much more computer horsepower and more bandwidth. Use with caution if you're using an older computer or a slow connection. Thank you, David.
No, that's a really good point. I mean, and really it does, a lot of it comes down to that, because even if you have that selected, and all of a sudden your service is super slow, some of these things just dumb it down to mono. So they do it for you. But I mean, personally, I mean, if I'm going to at least give it a shot to be in stereo, because I like stereo, you know, it sounds cool. and everything that I do is created in stereo, so that, you know, but it's got to sound good in mono. I always reference that. So just that little side road there. This is probably out of whack, but one of the things that we need to do is bass management. Low frequency management is a big thing. So when we start getting into building a mix and getting it to sound good, one of the fundamental things that we really need to look at is how do we control low frequencies? You know, how do we do that? And how do we get a mix that fits well together? So you'll listen to a lot of iconic engineers who will say, yeah, just don't use EQ, you know, or yeah, I would never do that because blah, 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 blah. But you have to take into consideration when Al Schmidt says he uses nothing but omnidirectional mics for his trumpets and saxes and bidirectional ribbon mics for his trombones, he's in Capitol Studio, man. It sounds great. It's hard to mess it up. And he's working with the best players on the planet who are providing the best sounds ever. You know, and he did the Toto 4, I think it was. And it sounds great. And he did some of the Steely Dan stuff, and it sounds great. But they're the best players on the planet who know the sounds that they really need to have to make a product great. So in order to address the needs of a stream, you have to address low frequency management, or you can't get it to sound loud enough. And so when we first started doing this, I went around and checked a couple other church streams that I knew were, you know, larger churches. And a lot of the problems I heard was just like, they're just trying to make it sound too big. You know, it's like this big flabby low end going on, but it sounds quiet then, you know, and I've done some things in my books where I'll do comparisons. It's like, okay, here it is this way with lots of bass and it sounds really quiet. And here's the exact same mix at the exact same level where I've controlled the low end and it sounds loud and perky. So, you know, it's an important consideration. So I don't know why that slide's there, but it's good to talk about it anyway. Here. So you can see that on this, down the lower right, that multi-band limiter is on the output, the final output of the board. And I've got it set so that it's riding the bass, you know, the red area down there on the left-hand side. It's riding the bass more than anything. And what that does is it lets me push the mix a little harder into a little hotter, you know, and get it closer to what we will find is the ideal level. And so in a little bit, we'll see what that is and how to achieve it. So as we get into systems, I mean, I didn't want to cover much about systems, but the thing that stalls everybody is, like, you know, you start to look at you're starting to look at your venue, whether it's a church or whether it's somebody who's, you know, doing a club or whatever it is, it doesn't really matter. It's daunting because, you know, you're looking at video cameras and they're not cheap, and you're looking at what kind of audio gear is it going to take to do this. And you see the stuff on TV and it's like, oh, that really looks kind of expensive. And, you know, mixing gear and software, and in the streaming world, mixing gear includes switchers, you know, the video switchers, and, you know, encoders. You need an encoder. So you always need something that's going to encode the data so that it can get into the right, to the stream the right way. So what do I do about that? There are really expensive external encoders, which, you know, isn't the focus of this tonight, but we need to know that they're there. And then, you know, just different live streaming accessories, effects, different tools that you can put in a system, and then a content delivery network. And so if you're really at the high end, you can take all of this stuff and make it all separate, and you can create this awesome stream that's super hi-fi, and you have a content delivery network that maintains your quality. And delivers it real time to all the services on the planet, or is super, super secure, which is, you know, really important to a lot of people. A lot of people that are doing business stuff wouldn't want to be on Facebook Live. So As we go through that, I have to click, you know, you end up seeing cameras. I mean, you get a camera like this, like $600. You get a camera like this, it's $2,000 to $4,000. You get a camera like this, it could be 60 grand. And people are proud of their Red cameras, man. It's a big, big name, you know, and that's for the body. And then you get the lens and all the other stuff. And then you have to have remote pan tilts, which can be, you know, really expensive. You can get them for a couple $100 or if you want to, you know, have a lot of control and precision more. Or if you want to hold a really super heavy camera, this one will hold a 155-pound camera at 62 grand. So there's all sorts of things that are just scary about putting these systems together. I like this little camera right here. I think it's cool. It's $2,500 and it's robotic. So everything's controlled through the controller in this, wherever the studio is that you have, video studio.
Bill, we have a question, but I don't know that it can really be addressed, from Bill Bainbridge. A recent Zoom for voice only to London came back with horrible echoes that were uncontrollable easily and very distracting due to a 1 or 2 second latency of the original speaker's voice. Also, the far voice returned with heavy distortion, but sounded like compression algorithm problems. Any notion about what could have caused this?
Well, you know, I do the international streaming thing all the time because most of my Berkeley classes are international. So I don't really think it's that, but it's usually because your bandwidth is just not, you're not up to speed on your bandwidth. And to do a stream, like a live stream, they recommend that your bandwidth, you have at least 20 gigabit bandwidth. That's the speed of your internet. Megabit. 20 megabit internet. That's because I'm trying to think. I have gigabit, so that's fast. But you have to have the right speed to be able to get everything there. And then you also have to make sure, and one of the things that I called Steve today and we were trying some stuff too, and it's like I had PageMaker and Final Cut and Illustrator, and I mean I just had everything open. And it was causing latency. It was causing it sounded funny to him. He said I was all choppy and stuff. You know, everything about this is bandwidth related. So if you really want to be efficient with your stream, you have to strip everything down. You know, you have to, it's like
and a. Bill, we have a good answer from Lawrence, actually, if I can jump in. Oh, echo in video conferencing is often caused by someone using speakers instead of headphones. And the signal they hear is picked up by their mic, and bandwidth and speaker at the other end turned up is these things.
Yeah,
no. Everyone must be muted unless they're talking, and always use headphones.
Right. Well, that is absolutely true. Reminds me of the thing we did with Phil Ramone out at London Bridge Studio, Steve.
Yeah, that was challenging.
Yeah, same problem. I mean, you know what? We tackle these problems, and the thing I like about the group of the AAS is that everybody's problem solvers. You know, it's like, oh, I can think that through. But that's right. You know, you can't have your speakers on. I mean, it kind of always comes back to the core stuff. If there's any latency and you've got your speakers on, then that's going to double that by the time it gets back to the other person. It's super annoying. So yeah, headphones are the right way to go, or a headset. You know, Dan Morton has a headset, and I think that sounds really good. So
and let me add, Bob Smith adds, we had a 1 second loop back on Echo Canceller due to interface buffer size. It was terrible at 256 and worked at 1024. So there you go. We should let you get back to your presentation though. So thanks.
No, all that stuff's good. I mean, because one of the things that I, with this group, I mean, it's such an intelligent group of people, a lot of scientists and designers and engineers, and I'm very confident about the topic I'm talking about, but I don't know all about, you know, every little bit of the technical part. I mean, I want to, and I when I started doing this presentation, it's like, I probably should go a little that way, a little that way. And so finally, like, first of all, I don't have time. Second of all, it's not, I'd be like a high school report, you know, it's like, oh, I just saw this on a Google site and I'm going to recite it to you. So I'm trying to stick to stuff that I know and have experienced and can really help with.
You're doing good.
All right. Yeah. Thanks, Steve. I'm encouraged. Or you can have a human pan tilt, which is, you know, a camera operator. And you know, that probably doesn't get any better than a camera operator, but you either have to pay them or they have to volunteer. And then you have to have an appropriate communication system. And most people use the ClearComms, and they're expensive, you know, it's money. So it's all an investment. And this is all why it's pretty daunting to put these systems together. And when you look at switchers, you've got everything from, you know, $2,500 to the little one in the middle, which is $600. And there's a little brother to that that's $300. And then you've got this one over here on the right, which looks really cool. And it's $39,000. So, I mean, I think that's why people, they're reluctant. That's why when I put a system together and I had a $1,000 switcher and I had a couple $2,500 cameras and I had some cables and other stuff that you have to put in there, it just seemed too expensive and was kind of frightening. But now everybody's kind of getting it. We are in the streaming era now. I mean, I don't think this is going away. And I love doing these meetings stream because I just don't, when I'm done, I walk upstairs. It's awesome. I don't have to drive home. So communications wise, I'm trying to stick to things that have to do with audio. The two main communications protocols in the video world are HDMI, high definition multimedia interface, and SDI, serial digital interface. And they both have, they both work great. So I don't think there's a quality difference between either one, but they have different capacities for cable length and different kind of connectors. So, and HDMI cables can only be up to 50 feet long. And a lot of times you're in a system, you're putting in a system and, you know, the room might be 200 feet long, you know, so you have to have a way to do that. SDI cables can be up to 300 feet. And so that's good. But most prosumer camcorders are HDMI, you know, they have a little mini HDMI jack on them. And so you have to address that. As soon as you get a switcher, those are the kind of things that you have to address. And the thing about HDMI, you know, it's prosumer, uncompressed video, and embedded audio. So the audio is right in with the HDMI cable up to 50 feet. And you can convert it to Cat 5 or Cat 6, you know, and then it can, that can go, it's nearly four. I think it's 300. I can't remember. I think it's only 321 feet actually, but it, you can go longer distances that way. HDMI 2 is the new protocol and it has a bunch of new bells and whistles, and in the HDMI, the normal HDMI is suitable for, you know, 1080, video, full HD. I think it's up to 60 hertz refresh rate, and the HDMI 2 is just super fast, you know, so you can support 8K at 60 hertz refresh rate or 4K at 120 hertz. So there's there are things to consider, but from an audio standpoint, we could say, oh gosh, man, I don't want to do it if it doesn't have HDMI 2.1. From version 1, multi-channel 192.24 audio was supported, so we're not losing anywhere in terms of being able to get audio from point A to point B. The 2.1 is good if you want to do Dolby Atmos and, you know, you got like lots and lots of speakers around, and that way the data is fast enough to support that and the video at the same time, you know, and do 8K 60 hertz refresh rate. SDI that's really kind of like the pro thing. And the nice thing about the SDI cables is they use BNC connectors, and they, you know, they snap on, they don't just pull out like an HDMI cable can. You know, it's the professional standard. And there are different levels of SDI. And the reason I brought this up is just because we should understand a little bit about what's going on with this. So there's 3 gigabit SDI, which is basically 1080p, 60 hertz. And then, you know, 6 gigabit and 12 gigabit support 4K and 4K 60. And then there's a quad link, which is 12 gigabits, four lines of 3 gigabit. And so, you know, there are different formats for it, but for what we're doing, we're pretty good right now, as long as we're just in the HD world, no matter what it is. This ultra speed HDMI goes up to 48 gigabit, and that's the 2.1. So if you, and as audio people, you're going to be the ones that this falls on probably a lot of times in smaller situations. The professionals, they're just going to do what they do, but you can convert and run. You can go 20 feet to this little converter box and run 300 feet to another converter box and back to HDMI. It's kind of like, they're just like direct boxes. You know, you can kind of go in either end and out either end and get your cable length that way. So, you know, that one's $300, and then this one's just a more stripped down version, but you can see on the right side, it's SDI and it's HDMI on the left side. And from an audio perspective, if you have a switcher and it takes HDMI ins, and that's what it takes, you can use this audio inserter, which basically replace, if you plug your audio into the upper right hand corner there, either the left, right, or optical, and the HDMI cable, then out of the other end, well, they'll strip out the audio that was on the HDMI in, and then add your audio to the out. So it's kind of a way to insert your audio into a new cable. So now here's the magic. So let me just say, when we did the stream, we're kind of getting to the point here, and I'm trying to keep moving quick enough so that it doesn't go forever, but we went with the iOS solution. And when we looked at the price of all those cameras, you know, the big cameras, and you know, some of them were exaggerated for the sake of a crowd, but the iOS stuff is just so amazing, you know. And the fact that you, first of all, can just use, if you want to stream, all you really need is an iPhone or an iPad, and that's it. You can just stream straight to Facebook Live. Not that that's really always the best place to stream, but it is a place. So and the camera is nothing. It costs nothing if you don't count the $1,100 that you paid for the phone. But it's just your phone. And the beauty of it is, you know, when we get to, when we do our stream at church and it's time for the broadcast, to set the broadcast cameras up, I pull my iPhone 11 Pro out of my pocket, and my daughter pulls hers out of her purse, and we're ready to rock, you know, and it's full. It's just awesome. So, you know, the iPhone is the thing, and it makes it easy. So, but even though we have that, we need to have a way to get the audio into the stream. So you always have to have that. And if you have a mixer, like the switchers that I showed you earlier, they just have audio inputs. You know, you just take the audio out of your board, plug it in there, and it integrates the audio with the stream. With the iOS world, which is really appealing to a lot of people, and it's an easy entry level. And if you're checking this out to see if you want to get involved in this, I can't recommend it highly enough, because it looks good. You use all Wi-Fi. Everything, you know, we use a thing called Switcher Studio, and it's, everything's controlled through an iPad, and that is the encoder. That's what's getting everything ready to go to Facebook Live and YouTube, and you know, you can send it to multiple places at the same time. And it's cheap, you know. So I happen to, you need an interface, you need an audio interface to go from the output of your mixer, whatever it is, to the iPad to enter the stream. And it just, a lot of these, all of these, will plug straight into the iPad from one end, and you plug the audio in the other end. And I have this one on the left here. I just happen to have that, the iConnect Audio 2 Plus. And it's a great little box, man, because it's on the back. If you look over this Presonus one, which is also a nice one, on the right, right in the middle there, it says device, and it's MFi. What that is, it receives, you can plug a USB cable in there, and that plugs Lightning into your iOS device. So it's super easy. and you can, you know, you build a stream and you're ready to rock. So I like this one. It just has stereo input. It's got like six outputs, but that doesn't really matter. And you can adjust the levels, and it's super, you can see what the levels are. It's really cool. You know, on this Switcher Studio thing, which is, you know, $39 a month. That doesn't have all the fun things. Right around $75 a month is where, that's where most people I think live. And it's, you know, you see all the cameras, you see, you know, it's just my iPad screen showing I was looking at the board. And then you can tell where you can send it. You can send them to YouTube Live, LinkedIn Live, Twitch, Facebook. You can, the RTM protocol is the one that everybody uses for streaming. It's an Adobe thing, actually originally a Macromedia thing. So, you know, you can tell what's up, you can tell what's on, you can overlay everything. You can play other videos from this. It's just, it works so good, man. And it's just, it's a workhorse. And, you know, we do live, we tried to do a pre-recorded thing once, but man, that was ugly because there was too many opportunities to stop. And I love the pending doom of real live broadcast. So, but when we look at the audio that comes out of the stream from the switcher, which is the encoder, the iPad or the switcher that you have, which can be an encoder or the dedicated encoder. The audio is not pure, man. It's just, it's compressed. And coming back from Facebook, it's all 720. So you can't go full 1920 by 1080. And it's, the audio comes back M4A, which is, you know, it's kind of a weird format. And so what I did is I took out of this Allen and Heath board, I've got a tone generator. And I sent tones and noise to my, to Pro Tools. And I have the direct send that's coming from the computer, and I've got, and then I downloaded the files that I had sent to Facebook. And I just wanted to see what's going on, you know, what's it doing, and just be able to look at it. And so that's what this is. And if it's too loud, holler at me, I can turn it down. So, so that's a nice 1K. Okay, there's the return. I mean, shoot, I did that last time a few times. I mean, so that's a pretty radical change in my book. I mean, and I've done some, you know, you can do comparisons where you take music and do this, and you do the exact same thing. You run through the compression, and then you have the original, and then you line them up so they're perfectly in phase, and then you invert one, and then all that's left is the ugliness in the sound.
Bill, there's a question.
Okay.
For you to distinguish between dynamic range compression and data compression in context here.
I mean, data compression is like MP3, you know, it's like, it's a way to strip out stuff that somebody envisioned as being unnecessary for certain parts of the music. And that's data compression. It's whether it's MP3 or AAC's data compression, the lossless, data for our sake is, our WAV files and Apple AIFF files, but really pretty much everything else has some sort of a compression algorithm in it. And they're not all bad. What the standard is for the streaming world is MP3s at 128 kilobits per second. And that was the original iTunes quality. So we've gone far beyond that, but that's what they do. That's why this looks ugly. So is that enough of an explanation?
It was from Rick Chin. So if what he'd like is to adjust our vocabulary to make the distinction clear, because if we say compression in an audio context, and a digital context, it's sort of important to just, that's a new thing that we have to deal with.
Okay, yeah, awesome.
Exactly that.
Great point, Rick. That's that then. Yeah, I totally get that. So yeah, we're talking about data compression, where it's stripping out certain components of the data that either should be able to be reconstructed or maybe aren't necessary, so that it can make the file size smaller. So you're compressing the file size and not the dynamic range. So we're going to look at some dynamic range compressors pretty soon. So let's hear what's coming up next. All right, so pink noise in. Now the return. So when you look in the lower left-hand corner, I mean, that's monstrously different. In the upper left-hand corner, I mean, the high end's getting really tweaked. And I don't know if I'll show this one, but I have one that's the transients seem like they're missing to me too, a lot. So anyway, that's pink noise. And I've got the next thing up is white noise, just to see what it does with, the comparison. Pretty much the same. Then 100 hertz upper right. Nice and smooth. It's got all that waffly stuff in the upper right there. And if you look in the upper left, I mean, the direct ones, you know, very, very smooth colors in the spectrogram, you know, going from, you know, bright out. And then on the one that comes back, it's very kind of grainy. It's just not, it's totally different. And the 10K, there we go. So in the lower right, that's really the high frequency. No, the lower left is a high frequency thing. I mean, it's a pure sine wave. I mean, you can see it. You can see it on the lower left, far left, and then the window right next to it. It's just, it's pretty clean. But then when it comes back, I don't know if you guys are hearing that, but man, I am.
We are. It's painful. Thank you.
Yeah. So it's just, it's amazing the difference between those two. So something's going on with the audio, and we need to realize that, which if nothing else, it's going to help us to try to push to get it better, you know, and better. I'm a big Amazon Music fan now, because they're able to stream, you know, 192.24 audio files. And it's great. I was a Tidal fan before that, when it was just like, okay, now they can do 44.116. And, and then they came up with the MQA, Master Quality Audio. And, you know, everybody's trying to do this, but so we need to kind of get out of this. And I hope the streaming world, if it stays like it should, there should be enough momentum and impetus to, I think that's the word, to see some growth there, because it's unsatisfying. That's what it is. So let's go to the next one here. So when we're dealing with setting up a mix, and that's, I want to talk a little bit about this, and tell me, make sure you guys tell me what time you want me to stop yakking. When we're setting up a mix as a streaming engineer, as opposed to a live sound engineer, they're two completely different things, you know? So with a live sound engineer, you've got a big sound system. So this is our church right here. So this is on the left. That's, you know, we've got three line array JBL VRXs, I think, per side, with an 18-inch subwoofer hung. And, you know, each one of the speakers has its own mono bridged amp and getting 1500 to 2500 watts, I guess, or so. And so there's a lot of power and there's a lot of people and there's a lot of noise and we get to go pretty loud, you know, it's a healthy sound, but everything about the gig for the live sound engineers is about that house. Nothing else really matters. It's like, what's it sound like in the house? And then the stream in the upper right-hand corner, that's what we were reduced to on March 15th. It's like, okay, now we're in my daughter's house with a TV behind us so it can have like graphics and lyrics. And we're just going to, you know, do some music and the preacher's going to preach. So it's a completely different thing. And in that world, the considerations are 100% different. So, yeah. So, I mean, that's just a little description of our sound system. We just have a lot of stuff going on. And then everything's about the house sound. You know, the balance, the effects, board, you know, if we're doing a board recording, that's pretty incidental, you know. And then sometimes we have to worry about monitors and different zones in the sound system. And we have to be the encourager, listener, politician, and psychologist at all times. But for the front of house operator, the stream is a secondary consideration. And so there are different ways to do this. I just wanted to go through a few ways that one operator could tackle this problem. And so, you know, you can set up a broadcast feed with a post fader aux. And once you set the relative levels, it works okay. I'm going to show pictures here in a sec. You can use a matrix. You can set up a separate post EQ pre-fader mix if you want to just be a little bit pickier with separate from the house. Or you can do headphones and an iPad in a separate room, or you can do it for the full meal deal and use a splitter and set up a separate board and everything. So with the post fader aux, and this really works pretty well, and I've done this a lot. It works best if it's on stereo. You've got the faders down at the bottom, which is where you set up your mix. And then that red band in the middle there, if you set all of those on unity gain and set them as post fader, then that's exactly what the board mix should be. That's your fader moves are being reflected in the aux, and that's all good. But in every room, you're going to have the drums are going to be really loud in the room, and even if they're in a cage, and so they're going to be really quiet on the recording. If anybody has an amplifier on stage, a guitar amp or a bass amp, that's going to be really loud in the room, or it's going to be really quiet in the recording. Vocals need, you know, they need everything they can get from the sound system, so they're going to be right in front, and that's an uncomfortable spot for a lot of vocalists. It doesn't make them secure. And then, you know, guitars running direct, acoustic guitar, they all have to be treated differently in the room, and everything for the sound operator is about the house. It's not about anything else. But if these were the drum tracks, the far left six tracks or so, six channels or so on that mixer, if you turn those channels up a little bit and you turn some of the other channels, the vocal channels, down a little bit, you can end up over a pretty short course of time, you know, a rehearsal, checking things, so that mix pretty much reflects what's going on in the house. I mean, I've done it a lot. I like that approach because I've always hated board mixes because they don't sound good. Ours sound pretty good because we're loud enough, but most of them just don't sound good. Or you can use a matrix, which the matrix, for most of you who would know this is an old school analog board. It's really, really easy to see what's going on. You've got subgroups, all the main outputs, subgroups, left, right. And this board had a center. This is a JBL, no, Soundcraft. So if you sent your drums to subgroup one, and you sent your guitars to subgroup two, and you sent your keyboard to subgroup three, and you had your vocals on subgroup four, you could rebalance all of those subgroups for the matrix. And the matrix has always been really great for feeding overflow rooms or for feeding broadcast feeds. You know, it's the same thing. You set up a relative level and it works well. It's pretty simple on an analog board. In this, like in the Allen and Heath, in a digital board, the matrix is all of the outputs, you know, which is, 14 outputs on the SQ6. I think it's just 12 on this SQ5. Auxes, they're all auxes, but you can make any of those auxes. You can reconfigure it however you want. You can have them all be subgroups. I have to use all the auxes I can get at the church for monitor systems, you know, and I like to run stereo, so that eats up a lot of a lot of oxes. But that's how you could rebalance all of those oxes. And if you're using your board in a way that made sense, you could totally rebalance everything with a digital matrix. And a lot of people use the Midas board, the X32. And it's real popular. It's real popular with my students at Berkeley. And it has all the same stuff, you know, it has all these same things. And same with the Personas boards. I mean, it's kind of gotten to that point where, you know, all guitars have six strings. Now all mixers have everything too. So, oh, that's the wrong direction, I think. Oh no, that's the pre-fader post-EQ aux. Same approach. And but another tool is everybody has in-ear systems now, is to just get your mix from an in-ear monitor. And you know, they are all pretty easy to use. I want to get to the music stuff here. What we're going to do when we go back to regular church is I've got a couple monitors, we've got a separate room, and I'm going to just set up an iPad in there. Either I'll do it or somebody else will do it. And just mix it with the iPad, and I'll set up. I've got auxes 13 and 14. They're already sent to the TVs in the different areas, and we'll just do a real mix, you know, for that on auxes 13 and 14. Just select them on the iPad. Maybe it's 11 and 12. I think there's 13. No, anyway, it's 11 and 12, but it doesn't matter. And it's pretty easy to get around on these things. You know, you've got groups of eight, but every one of these little chunks right above the IP34, IP35 gets you to an eight channel group. And you can open things up and you'll see this work in a second. There we go. And then, you know, this is like the next level where you use a splitter snake and you've got the front of house mixer and all the mics are just split out either passively or actively, depending on, you know, what's going on with the system, how many ways it has to be split and stuff. So, you know, you can send to a completely different mixer, or maybe it's the same model and make, but it doesn't really matter. You can just send it to a different room, and that's the broadcast room. And a lot of venues do that. You know, that's kind of like been the standard way to do it for a long time, but it's expensive because you have to have a board and you have to have splitter snake, and then you have to have all the stuff that goes around that. And then streaming without a live audience, that's what we're doing now. You know, it's like everybody in the church world has had to go to that. It's like there's no audience. So that opens up a completely different thing. And now the streaming engineer is a broadcast engineer. It's a completely different thing. It's a total switch, switch in mindset, because now levels are fundamentally important. I mean, you have to get a great sounding mix. I didn't wrap that one thing around there. This is from last night. Levels are fundamentally important. Dynamic control is important. You know, you have to have dynamic control in channels and the mix. And you have we're using dynamic compressors to control the louds and softs in the channels and in the mix. So that's, you know, everything's getting a little different through this. And then you have to conform to a loudness spec. You know, there's a way to quantify how loud your mix is. And there's a spec for all of these services that, you know, streaming spec seems to be minus 14 LUFS. And we'll talk about that in a sec. Gain structure is a big, big deal. So that's it's huge. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit. You know, it's huge in connecting analog gear, using plugins and the output, master output level. So this is the signal generator section of this Allen and Heath board. And so a lot of the young guys and girls they can't relate to this because they've never had to worry about it. And I haven't had to worry about it for a long time because I've been, you know, digital for a while. Anytime you hook an analog piece of gear into the system, you have to actually set the levels so that you're certain that those levels reflect what's coming from, what's going into them accurately. Because it's totally possible to set something up where you've got a you know, your output level from your board is super hot. You know, it's easy because, you know, faders keep moving up and everything. You're trying to hear this and you turn that up and it's totally the wrong way to mix, but it happens. And so you're, it's totally possible the output of your board can be super hot and you're overdriving the next stage no matter what you do. And so, and then that level has to be super cold, so it's not working really well, you know, and you're getting more noise than the board you need and it's distorted when it goes in and you can't fix that. And so it's super important that as soon as you put one of these interfaces in or you put, you know, you add hardware between in the mix bus, you always have to worry about that. Anytime you're going to an analog recorder of any kind, you have to do this same process. But it's, I'll try to turn this down quick enough here. There we go. Where is it? So, you know, that's just a 1 kilohertz tone. And, but it goes up to zero on the DBFS meter. And it's zero on the board, and then you have to set the interface to zero. And it's not hard to do, but a lot of people just don't do it. You know, they just kind of like, okay, I just can't deal with that because they don't know they had to deal with it. It's really pretty simple that way. So it's very important that we control our gain structure. And if you don't have a frequency generator on your board, this little function generator, which is an iPhone app, is really, really good. I have it on my iPhone. I've used it before. But then you also have to control your gain structure going through through all of your dynamic compressors. So this compressor. So and all of this stuff, I mean, is we did have this discussion. It's like, well, it's just not doing with a stream. It's, you know, is it important? But this all really has to do with how your audio is going to sound in the stream. I mean, it's just, it's fundamental to it. So I want to spend a little bit of time on it. So if you look at this compressor, you know, the Waves H Comp, and I use it a lot for my evaluations in my class just because I think it looks cool. And I'm going to, this is a video, so I'm going to play it and it doesn't really have any sound. So that'll be helpful. So you know, you set up a compressor so that it's, you know, you get 3 dB of gain reduction or so, or, you know, it just depends on how hard you want to hit it. Sometimes there's more, it just depends on the signal. But, you know, that's kind of a normal looking setup for a compressor, and that's gain reduction. And most people, that's as far as they go. But if you check the input level, I'm just hammering the input on the thing, and there's no hope for that signal to ever sound clean and pure, if that's what you want. And the output is even worse. So, you always have to check your gain structure on all of your plugins and on all your devices. And it's, it seems like it should be, you know, a little bit more of a no-brainer than it is, but I just see in my students, especially, that it's not happening. And there's a generation that's coming up that hasn't had to worry too hard about this stuff. So, and what I did there is I just turned the clip gain down on the source, and it was this is something that came in and it was hot already, not distorted, not peaking, but hot. So I turned that clip gain down a little bit, and now everything looks, you know, really nice, and I can get a little bit of compression there, hit the compressor a little bit, and then check the output, and that's too hot. So then I can take the output back to Unity, and it, that's perfect. You know, it's like, oh yeah, that's really cool. That's how it should be. You know, that's how it should look. And input, gain reduction, and output all fit spec. So it's very important that we do that. And then there's loudness. And we've got different things. We've got peak level metering and something called LUFS. And I don't know how many people know about LUFS, but in about 2012, this new standard came out and it was a surprise. To me, because I didn't know anything about it, and all of a sudden I start hearing about this thing, and it's loudness units full scale, and what it does, it lets you quantify how loud something is. And some of the mastering engineers, I did a book with a guy that was a big WaveLab, I think it was WaveLab, really good at WaveLab, and he showed me this stuff like right when it came out, so it's like, oh, that's really cool. And what LUFS are, loudness units full scale, that's the distance between the peak level and the average level. So it's kind of like peak minus RMS is kind of what it is, the peak minus the, and so if you would imagine if the distance between the peak level and RMS was 100 dB, then a lot of it, anything except the peaks would sound really quiet. You know, it's like it, if you could get a peak that would be that hot. So the more you push, the more you push that bottom, the quiet stuff up, you get a smaller negative number. These are negative numbers because zero, zero, and everything else is like, okay, I'm 14 D below D, my average level is 14 dB below my peak level. And so everything is being quantified in lux right now. TVs, you know, minus 22 or 23, that's what they want to have. I did a course, a microphone course for Berkeley. LinkedIn Learning. And they spec'd 18, minus 18 lufs. And so, you know, you just get your lufs meter out and you figure it out and you conform. And streams want the standard there is minus 14 lufs. And so I've got a thing I'll show you coming up here. A regular pop record, you know, I don't know, Katy Perry. Oh, I don't know. Any one of those. It's probably 12, 11, 12 lufs, you know, that's about, and it's, you know, you can hear it get louder as you're adjusting this. You know, the heavy metal groups are single digits for sure. Some lower than others. And then, you know, you look at a jazz thing, you know, might be in the 20s, you know, just depends on the kind of jazz, but it's something we need to deal with. And the manufacturers, the Allen and Heath guys, I'm going to be pretty good friends with them. And I first thing I did when I started doing the streaming thing is I called and it's like, you guys got anything coming out pretty soon, a plug-in or lufs? Because, you know, they have all sorts of different plugins. And it's like, nope, don't have it. But I was encouraged that he was saying, well, maybe we can do that pretty soon. And so, you know, that's I don't know how big of a maybe that was, but we kind of need that if we're going to be able to do this new era of broadcast audio, because it's important, you know, it's important that we do that. And one of the things that you fight when you're trying to do a stream and you have multiple sources is you've got, you know, somebody's doing a bit on their iPhone and the iPhone is just, you know, it's just compressing the bejeebers out of it. And it's like super loud. But then your audio stream that you've been sending is quieter than that. Oh, that's not good. You hate that. So I'm always pushing the mix. I mean, I think I'm right about in the right range. I have to pull it out to check, on Pro Tools, and I'm pretty close. But you know, you want everything to be of the same level. And when you're doing it live, there has to be a way to check that. So I'm hoping that the manufacturers start to see that this is a real deal and they start to give us some tools to measure these things. And, you know, they're all smart people. They can come up with it. So let's see. All right. So I'm going to play this. So these meters, the bottom meter is a kind of a combo, peak meter, RMS meter, the Duro. And or Duro, I don't know. I always forget which way I heard it last. And then VU meters. So when we look at the same source going to those meters, and you won't hear any sound because it doesn't really matter. Here we go. You see the peak meter on the bottom is always kind of going up to minus four. You know, it's kind of like that's, I've got it on hold, but it's staying right in there. And this VU meter is a little more sophisticated than some because it has a hold feature and it tells you what your peaks have been. But anybody who's had any experience with VU meters knows that they're an average level meter. And so the peaks can exceed that average by 9 dB easy. So you always have to be very careful with percussion instruments and stuff. But when you look at this and you look at what's happening with those meters, that meter on the top will make you mix a different mix because you're going to feel like some parts are too low and you're going to find ways to get that up. And then you're going to see on one of the meters, it maxed out at 2.1 plus 2.1 and the other meter maxed out at minus 2.0. And so you want to find what caused that to happen. So it sends you on a journey that you would never go on if you were just using the bottom meter. It's like, well, what's causing that? And in the old old days, you know, everything was VU meters. And I just remember some Ampex two-track that we had these great big VU meters, man. And if you got them going, they could hardly stop. And you'd always find that you'd play the mix and there's some floor tom or something that was too loud and it was dominating the entire mix level. And you can't have that. So, you know, all you have to do is you get your, you know, the third chair mix engineer who's got those faders over there, an old school, and just have them turn that one track down for that little bit. And then all of a sudden you can push the entire mix up another couple dB. So mixing to the VU meters is a big deal. It's a little easier on the peak meters because you're just trying not to peak. You're not necessarily thinking about all these other things. So let's just move on here. So this is this from a video that is in that ebook. So I'm not really trying to pitch the ebook, although I did it. You know, I've written a lot of books. And so over the years, just since we're stopping here, over the years, I've written a lot. And I've written a lot of books with other people. And then when this whole thing happened, and it's like, when we did the first stream, the church office started getting calls and people were saying, how come yours sounds good and ours doesn't sound good? You know, why is that? And, so, you know, they feel nice to let me know that. And it occurred to me that I was kind of naturally doing a lot of stuff that I always would have done that could be really, really useful for people to know. And that's why I wrote that. And I've never done an ebook before. Well, some of my stuff has been in ebooks, but I've never like just written an ebook and self-published it. And it was really a cool experience. And my publishers, you know, everybody's on furlough and they're just gone and they won't pay me anything. And I said, what the heck with you guys, man? I'm doing this ebook and I did it super fun. I did an audiobook version of it too, because I always wanted to try that. So there's videos that go along with this book, you know, and so this is one of those. And that's why it's got this screen on it, because I just swiped it off of my YouTube channel that has the holds of stuff. So here, this will show you a little how the Luffs meter and the music that I'm using is something that's, you know, pretty passive, but you still see what's going on with it. Luffs and stuff. I made that up. The loudness unit's full scale Luffs meter is a handy meter to have around. More and more different genres of music, different applications and formats are finding a specific Luffs setting that works best. Television industry is around minus 23 Luffs. Most pop music is right around 11 or 12 Luffs. Basically, these are all negative numbers, and the closer you get to zero, the louder it gets. The measurement is from the peak level to the average level. Let's look at this one tune. It has a wide dynamic range, and it builds throughout the tune. But if this were used for streaming, the target Luffs for a stream is 14, minus 14 Luffs. As the tune plays, I'll adjust the settings so that we find that minus 14 Luffs range. You can see the Luffs readings here. There's a peak meter and an average meter. And then this is what we're going to use to push that mix up into the Luffs scale. So far, this is pretty open. Our short turn Luffs just came up to about 17, 16. Long term is minus 20. Now if I move this limiter, move the threshold down, the mix starts to sound louder, and notice the Luffs are really changing here. Set this for minus 0.5. So long-term Luffs were right in the pocket here. And if I back this limiter off, put it back on. Back it off. You can tell that that really makes a difference in the loudness, and that compared side by side, those two mix levels would be dramatically different, especially if they're over a stream or they're broadcast. The listener would hear a big difference between those two levels. So yeah, I'm tired of hearing myself talk there. The so with this is a limiter, a peak limiter, and the way peak limiters work, well, probably all of you know, but as you move the threshold down, the output automatically goes up. So it's perfect for shaping the loudness of a mix in terms of LUFS, because you just move the threshold down until you get the desired response from your LUFS meter. And this is the Waves loudness meter, I think it is, Waves loudness meter plus. It's got a true peak. True peak's a little different. There are spaces between the samples, and there are ways for peaks to get through those spaces. And this will meter those, just in case you're worried about them. So, you know, that it's really important that we are able to work with that. And that's why I'm hoping that the manufacturers will get on the ball and give us something. If you're working with a high-end Soundcraft, or you're working with a venue, then this is, it's built in for you. There's no problem. If you're working with any, you know, avid product, you're good to go. But this is a great LUFS meter. Also, the Isotope products are great. You know, they have some really nice meters. You know, it's just like, it's very, very cool. So anyway, there you go. So as soon as we start looking at this from a broadcast perspective, it's almost like live recording / broadcast because everything's stripped down. You have when we're doing a live gig, or it's a live church service, we're using close mics, and we're using a lot of them. And close mics aren't always the best mics in terms of sound, but they give you the separation that you need. And so we're stuck with them. You know, we use close mics on the drums. Drum mics, if you move them up a little bit, you know, 4 inches up, and aim them at the center of the head instead of pointing them right down at the drum, they can actually sound pretty good. But if you point them right down at the drum, they don't sound very good. So, you know, if you're using good mic technique, that's very, very helpful. And if you're using decent mics, that's helpful. You know, the SM58 is a workhorse. I really like that Beta 87. It's a condenser mic, handheld. And that blue Model 200 is an active dynamic mic. It's got a little EQ circuit built into it, I think. Sounds nice. But as soon as we call ourselves broadcast or studio, all of a sudden, all of these kind of mics start to come into play, you know? And so I've been using all these, and I'll show you in a sec how they work much better than the approach that you would normally take. You know, everybody comes up and they're live sound people, and they just do it that way because that's what they've always done. But you know, this, and these mics are a little more expensive, you know, but you can get cheaper versions. I mean, I did a bunch of instructional stuff for Hal Leonard for music stores. It was kind of like teach a music store owner and their staff about the products they sell, so they'll know more about them. And so I got a lot of really inexpensive microphones at my house to do some of this stuff. And really, a lot of them were pretty nice, you know, $70, $60.
Bill,
yes.
We have a question. What would you recommend for room mic integration into a streaming mix from a live room?
Well,
I've been from James.
Who's that from?
James Brummett.
Okay. So for a room mic, any large diaphragm condenser mic is going to be like the choice for a lot of these. I've been using a Royer SF12, and it's a stereo ribbon mic. And, you know, they're kind of pricey, but it's That's awesome. You know, but you can do, if you're in a room that has a sound, and even in a live thing, I set, you know, one up on one side of the stage and one up on the other when I can, large diaphragm, and we're just using the Shure KSM32. And it's a reasonably priced microphone. It's super clean. It's kind of like a cross between a small diaphragm and large diaphragm in terms of how it sounds. So any mic like that will work well. But you can also go with something like a small diaphragm condenser. You know, the Rode has some, what is it? The NT4, I think, is the stereo version, and NT2. Their stuff is really nice.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
NT4 is the stereo XY fixed.
Yeah. So you know, you don't necessarily want that because you kind of want it in a room. You want to separate them. In a studio, you know, for rooms, I mean, I'll always use, you know, U87s are great. I mean, it's what we're talking here is, well, what can we afford to use, and what would you really use if you money were no object and it was somebody else's money? So room mics, large diaphragm condensers, even, you know, this ATM 4047 MP is an awesome microphone. The mic that's kind of hidden on mine behind the group of people, because I'm full screen on my presentation here, is an Audio-Technica 5045, which is a really cool mic. Those would work.
And Bill, while we have you, just to let you know, it's 8:15, so are we like 15 minutes away, or?
Yeah, let's be 15 minutes away.
Cool. 8:30 seems like a good target, just to let you know. Thanks okay. very much. And then we'll do introductions around the room.
Yeah. And if there are any other questions, that's fine. So we'll keep moving through, you know, more microphones. I mean, I like Royers a lot. I like ATs a lot. I like AKGs a lot. I mean, I like Shure a lot. I got a lot of really nice Shure microphones. But, you know, one of the things that you'll find when you start using these different kind of microphones is that when you use them correctly and you're not having to fight a room and a sound system, you can get some pretty darn nice sounds without an awful lot of work. And so, this microphone is one that I mentioned using, and this is the Solomon Low Freak. It's LOFREQ. And that's what I use for a kick mic now. And it's really good. It works really well when you put it up really close to the head, as opposed to like the sub kick. I always kind of had to move it around a little bit more and kind of find the thing. It probably works close well to the Yamaha. And I also I've got NS10 monitors that are out in the open. I've got everything I could rip out of a speaker cabinet, I've got wired up. And all you do to wire up a speaker for a microphone is just take the positive and negative pins and have that be one and pins one and two on an XLR connector. And, you know, that's kind of the essence of it. And so this little thing works really well, and it's a couple hundred bucks maybe, and it works great on floor tom too. So when we come up to the next bit, I'm going to show you, I used one of these. I'll show you where I used it. And last night, Glenn Lorbecki was on here and he made me get a picture of it. So I got it just before we started. It's a great, great little mic. It also, I did some vocal stuff. I've done a lot of group work with a group called the Coates, acapella vocal with kind of acapella with a band or acapella with whatever.
Bill, Rick points out that speaker connections go to pins 2 and 3, not 1 and 2.
Oh, you're right. 2 and 3. I should have said that.
Thank you, Rick.
I knew that, Rick, and thanks for prompting me on that. I was rattling on. 2 and 3. One's ground or shield. So the other thing, and I don't really necessarily want to play all of this, I don't think, but the other thing that I noticed that came back from the stream was the transient. This probably should have been up with the rest of those, but I was shuffling things around at the end. Transients are really important. You know, it's like the transient, that super fast attack on when an acoustic guitar player uses a pick and hits a string, you know, that's cool. And when a drummer hits the snare, there's a lot of transient there. When the drummer hits a rim shot, there's more transient there. Let me run this here. So what I did is I recorded a bunch of drum hits, you know, just like a stick on a rim, and to get some transient stuff to just see how they lined up and if they were the same or if there were any differences. And there's a lot of differences, you know, when you look into the waveform and you zoom in, there's just a lot of difference in that transient. And with this, you know, you can, So when this starts playing, it's, what's happening in Pro Tools, you can select something and press Command M and that mutes it. Those are the gray ones. So the one that you're hearing is the colored one. On the top is the direct from my the SQ5, the Allen & Heath to Pro Tools, and the bottom went to Facebook and came back. So with the stick, it's a transient, but it's not a huge difference in terms of the stick. You know, that's direct. You know, a little duller. So with these headphones on, which are really pretty darn accurate, I can hear differences there. I doubt that that's transferring over the stream. But this next one, when I started using this little metal rod, which should be a more extreme transient, I think you'll be able to hear a difference in this in terms of the one that was direct and the one that came back from Facebook. So I don't know if you can. I can, so I know that it's there. And if I zoom in on it, you know, you can see that there's a difference in that transient, which there's a difference in the transient. So there. That's the little metal rod. Somehow, it must be a frame rate thing or something, but somehow that was slipping out of sync because I locked him in earlier. But they look different. So let's move on. Low frequency management is a big deal. I mentioned it earlier, and I just want to kind of show a couple of things that I use a lot that help. And the reason it's important for a stream is because, like I said, if you get too much low frequency and you get things fighting in the low frequency, it causes the level to be artificially low. And, you know, because that the low frequencies will count in that average level. I mean, a lot, you know, the low frequencies on a VU meter, which measures average level, they dominate the VU meter. You know, they don't do it so much on the peak meter, but they dominate the VU meter. So I use a lot of high pass filter, and that's kind of just, this is showing this. I do a lot of stuff where, especially when a close miking situation, it's a little different with what we're doing here, and I'll show you that in a sec. But, you know, I'll do a lot of stuff where, you know, it's pretty standard on a kick drum to go up to 300 or 400 hertz, 350, 400, and just do a big cut, you know, until the kick drum rounds out and you can hear it. So it's almost like you turn the kick drum up when you turn that frequency down, because all of a sudden you hear the nice thump on the low end and you can hear a better attack on the high end. And so, you know, we'll do a lot of that. But then once you've created that hole in a live thing or a stream thing, when you can bypass that and hear what the difference in the sound is, that's only part of the gain. The rest of the gain is when you listen for what goes away with that band, because there's a lot of really ugly leakage in those ranges that are, you know, too muffly, and you can make it sound like you just lifted the blanket off the sound. That's kind of one of the standard analogies. So let's see what happens in this here.